Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
1 year on from the Hamas attack on Israel, Global News podcast listeners have been sending in their questions for BBC correspondents about everything that's happened since, about the escalating conflict in the wider Middle East, and where we might go from here to try to bring an end to the bloodshed. Find the Global News podcast special edition on the Middle East in the regular Global News podcast feed, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour here on the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. And that was the sound of fresh Israeli airstrikes against Hezbollah targets in Beirut's southern suburbs. The explosions were loud and huge plumes of flames could be seen against the black night sky. They were launched once again just as the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel had made progress on this new front of the war.
About a month ago, towards the end of the destruction of the Hamas battalions in Gaza, we began to fulfill the promise I gave to the residents of the north. We eliminated Nasrallah and the top echelon of Hezbollah. We eliminated the commanders of the Radwan force, who planned to invade Galilee and carry out a greater and more terrible massacre of our citizens than the one on October the 7th.
In a recorded message broadcast to Israel on Saturday night, Mr. Netanyahu also stressed that his country would not allow Iran's attacks on Israel to go unchallenged. The Prime Minister's today been visiting troops along the Lebanese border. This resident of Beirut was displaced by the ongoing fighting.
We have been displaced for 10 days now. We don't have food with us. You're not even able to go and get new clothes. We left our homes and came here. Every night there's a strike. You cannot sleep. We came here and we're unable to go back from where we came. Our situation is terrible. If anyone is able to find any way to get out of the country, they should. It's better than living on aid. People come and give us sandwiches. This is the way we're living now.
I've been speaking to Jemana Haddad, who's a prominent Lebanese poet, writer and translator. She's at home in Beirut, and I asked her to describe her experience of the most recent bombings.
Yesterday night was the most violent night so far in Beirut. Obviously, we can't sleep with all the explosions around us and with fear inside of us, because we already traumatized, especially ever since the explosion of the port of Beirut, because where I live is very near and my home collapsed over my head on that day. Ever since then, whenever I hear like the smallest sound, I start shivering. So you can imagine, not only me, so many of us. So talking about our mental state, I mean, what can I say? We're like living on the brink of life. We are just waiting to die. It's not life. We're not living. It's like we wake up in the middle of the night to the cold voice of a soldier telling us to evacuate immediately because the Israeli planes will strike. We can't sleep and we feel lucky compared to all those who have lost their lives, lost their loved ones, lost their homes. I mean, our families and our lives and our futures are held hostage. And the worst of it all is the children who are sleeping on the streets. Those are breaking my heart because, you know, that there are more than a million displaced people now, not to mention that more than 2,000 people who have been killed in less than 2 weeks and 10,000 who have been injured. But there are whole families sleeping on the streets because their homes have been bombed or because they could be bombed any second. And they can't count on anyone because, you know, we have a failed state in Lebanon. The institutions have collapsed. We have been struggling for the past 5 years, crisis after crisis, trauma after trauma.
What is the mental effect of this pileup of traumas that you describe? You were already, as you said, living in a failed state and now this.
I mean, we haven't started talking about this yet because we are still dealing with the physical side of what's happening. We are trying to stay safe. We are trying to help those who are in dire circumstances, who are in a worse situation than we are with the little that we have. But let me tell you something. Us Lebanese, we have lived so many wars and tragedies in this country and this region since I was a child that sometimes I feel like I'm 100 years old. I mean, civil war, murders, explosions, economic collapse, the port explosion in Beirut, trauma after trauma. It's like an endless cycle of death and despair. And I'm tired to hear about the Phoenix metaphor about Lebanon. Enough with that. I'm tired of hearing that we are a resilient people. We do not want to be resilient. We want to live. We just deserve to live. Many of those who are suffering, many of those who are dying are just collateral damage. And I do believe that they are using our misery to negotiate political, strategic, and financial profits under the table. And the international community, you know, the greatest powers of the world, as they call themselves, I do believe that they have all the resources necessary to initiate a real solution. Because this cannot be the only solution. I refuse to believe that this horror was the only solution.
The bombing's already got within, I think, 200 metres of your home. Do you feel like there's anywhere safe to go? Do you think of getting out of the city? Where would you go?
No, I cannot go out of the city, and I don't want to get out of the city because at least I'm trying daily to help those who are on the streets. But, I mean, who knows what building and what area in Beirut is going to be bombed next? So no one is safe. No person is safe. No place is safe. I mean, it's like threats could hit any of us at any time. And you don't know where to go because who knows what's under this or that building? Who knows who's hiding in this or that building? So I don't know what to say, Paul, because words seem so ineffective compared to what is happening to us. And it's a writer who's telling you this. I can honestly say that this is not life. This cannot be called a life. This is an excruciating wait for our turn to die.
That was Jumana Haddad, a Lebanese author and journalist, speaking to me from Beirut. Filippo Grandi has recently arrived in the Lebanese capital. He's currently at a school in the city that's become a shelter for around 1,200 displaced people. He is the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and he spoke to me earlier.
I'm in a school in central Beirut, one of 1,000 schools across the country that have been transformed in makeshift shelters for more than a million. The government says 1.2 million displaced people inside the country. These are people basically fleeing from the areas most impacted by Israeli airstrikes. And many are with families in the communities, but many, many do not have anywhere to go. So they're hosted in public buildings like this one. And sometimes, unfortunately, we've seen them all around the city. They are sleeping out in the open, in the streets. So this is a very, very urgent humanitarian situation that needs to be addressed.
Is there anything inherently safer about the refuge where you are now? Is it safer than other buildings?
The problem is there are some parts of Lebanon, southern Lebanon, the southern suburbs of Beirut, some parts of the Bekaa at the border with Syria that are completely unsafe because this is where the airstrikes are mostly happening. The rest of the country is relatively more safe, but it's very, very fragile. You know, I spent the night here and all night we could hear very nearby the booming of the airstrikes in southern Beirut. So this is a small country. This is not a huge country where you can find plenty of places for safety. This is why this has to stop as soon as possible.
How are people there coping? What are they saying?
The most remarkable thing is the many, many people I spoke to here all say the same things. Let this stop, please. Let them stop and we will go back home immediately. Even if our house is destroyed, we'll rebuild it. So there is a huge anxiety, a huge expectation that a ceasefire comes. And unfortunately, what we see on the international scene doesn't indicate that that is happening anytime soon. On the contrary, we see more expansion of military action and more people displaced. You know that well over 200,000 have also crossed into Syria, Syrians and Lebanese. So it's quite big. and people need everything. Local organizations, local community are doing fantastic work. The government is trying to coordinate, and the UN, the different agencies and other aid agencies are trying to help with everything, food, cash, medicines, water, sanitation, mattresses. This is all very much needed. We need more resources in order to keep up this effort until it's necessary.
What, in your opinion, is the route to making it stop? Is there one?
It's a ceasefire, and ceasefires are difficult in a complicated conflict. Remember, this comes on the heels of the Gaza conflict. Anniversary of the Hamas attacks is tomorrow. So 1 year going. We've been seeing for a long time this will expand in the rest of the region. It is now expanding. So what is needed is really for the international community to exercise even more pressure on all parties involved so that they go back to the negotiating table. May I say, and this is beyond my mandate, which is humanitarian, but a ceasefire in itself is important and urgent, but then there has to be political processes that cement and make the ceasefire sustainable.
And how dismaying is it for you, as a representative of the United Nations, that the UN seems to have almost no voice here, certainly not with the Israeli government?
The United Nations political mechanisms, Security Council and otherwise, have been pretty powerless in addressing this crisis. I was in New York a few days ago at the General Assembly. I came back disheartened by the paralysis of political action. And I keep warning everybody, humanitarian agencies will do what they can, as we're doing here. But we are also at the maximum stretching point. We can't go on like this. We need peacemaking to be restored, or else catastrophes will continue to occur.
Israel's line at the moment seems to be that if Hezbollah stops shelling northern Israel, and if they retreat their forces back to north of the Litani River, then the fighting will stop. Do you see hope there?
I hope that Israel and Hezbollah both will understand and accept that the only way forward is to silence the guns. And then you described exactly what the famous Security Council Resolution 1701 stipulates, which needs to be implemented. That's the political process I was referring to.
But in the face of that being ignored, how do you feel at the moment as you see the refugee crisis building?
I feel very, very worried. Once again, we'll pull up our sleeves. And believe me, you know, this is not a sideshow. Humanitarian agencies are risking their lives. We have lost ourselves, my organization, two people already in this war. People that were working in areas that are dangerous. But we will continue to do that. But our capacities are also limited, and we have so many theaters of war. So I am worried that we're reaching breaking point here.
That was Filippo Grandi, who is the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, speaking to me from Beirut. You're listening to the BBC World Service live from London. This is NewsHour. Coming up, Israel marks the first anniversary of the 7th of October Hamas attacks tomorrow.
I want my parents to be victims of peace, not victims of war, because I won't be able to justify it for myself and for my children that their grandparents, my parents, died for war. There is no excuse in dying for a war, but there is a great meaning in doing everything you can for peace.
We'll hear from hostage families, from the Israeli government, and from peace negotiators. The headlines this hour: Tunisians are voting in a presidential election with Kais Saied expected to win as his main opponents are in jail. And Kazakhstan is holding a referendum on whether to build its first nuclear power plant of the modern era. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour, live from the BBC. The southeast of the United States has been badly hit by Hurricane Helene. It killed at least 220 people, injured and displaced many more, and destroyed buildings and infrastructure in six states. The government has said a recovery will last years and cost billions of dollars. What was it like when the hurricane hit? I've been speaking to Laura Lee, who is news director of Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville in North Carolina.
Well, I think when the hurricane first hit, we did not expect, we the station and we the community did not expect the magnitude, the scope of the storm. We had had some rain before, and so the ground was saturated. So we knew there was potential for some flooding, but we were caught off guard. I think the community was caught off guard by just the massive scope of scale of the damage.
Obviously, you're used to describing the scope of it. For radio listeners, give us a taste.
I mean, apocalyptic damage. Roads that are very common thoroughfares for us that look nothing like anything we have seen. Mud covering so many parts of the community. Neighborhoods that you can't identify now because none of the familiar structures exist.
Am I right in saying that West and North Carolina are not used to such extreme conditions?
Absolutely not. You know, North Carolina has a coastline that is unfortunately quite used to having hurricanes, but we are many hours from that by driving. And we have storms, we have landslides, we have mudslides, but again, nothing of this size in recent history.
How did you scramble to report this? It must have been difficult.
We did scramble quite a bit. We're a relatively small team here at BPR. You know, we tried to initially just get a couple people out. We cover a 14-county area, so it's a pretty large landmass. Sent some people. We have one person who went south of here, of Asheville. We have actually a person based west of here in Silva, which is about an hour. Unfortunately, initially, we lost touch with both of those people, one for 24 hours and one for 48 hours. So information was very limited. Cell phone service was almost non-existent. Power outages. We had power outage here at the station. We had to run on generator power for a bit. So I think it was probably best described as chaotic.
What's been the story since the storm died down? What's happening?
You know, I think people keep turning to recovery and we're just not there yet. We're still in search and rescue. The community has, you know, emergency services, people going out, still trying to get to people in isolated parts of the county and the surrounding counties, people that the roadblock from a landslide or a mudslide has essentially stranded them. So there's still an active search and rescue activity going on in some of the more remote parts. Here in Asheville, we are without water. The water system has been almost completely destroyed. And a lot of, you know, 100,000 people were still without power. So it doesn't feel like we are emerging from the worst of this yet.
Quite a lot of people must know someone who died.
Yes. I mean, this is another part of the lack of communications. You know, we've gotten some reporting on fatalities, but I think officials are still struggling to notify loved ones, to make identifications, frankly, in instances of flooding, to recover bodies. I mean, there's still an active effort to do all of that. So I anticipated that we would turn to identifying and remembering those that have been lost. And that has been very, very limited so far.
That was Laura Lee, news director of Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, North Carolina. We'll take a break from the news of the day now to go back to the London of the 1980s, when a nightclub became home to a trend-setting cocktail of fashion, art and music. An exhibition called Fashion Renegades of the 1980s in London opened on Friday at the Fashion and Textile Museum here in the British capital. It centres on Taboo, a club opened by designer and performance artist Lee Bowery in 1985. Imposing as though your life depended on it or don't bother as the dress code, the Taboo Circle, which included stars such as Boy George, sparked a scene that used the language of hedonistic excess to create new popular culture. Sue Tilley worked at the club. She was a friend and muse to Lee Bowery, and like him, she was the subject of a painting by Lucian Freud. She told my colleague Julian Warwicker about Lee's personality.
Bizarre? No, sometimes it was really down to earth, normal person, you know, going to the shops, faffing on about his cooking, but at the same time, full of fantastic ideas.
He opened, didn't he, the Taboo nightclub, and you worked there. So talk us through how that all came about.
In those days, you could just hire a club for a night, and loads of people just open clubs. And then somebody asked him to do it with him. But of course, Lee took over and was the boss here. And yeah, the first couple of nights, it wasn't very busy. Then it kind of really became the complete place to go.
I like the dress code. The quote is, dress as though your life depends on it or don't bother.
I think some people did get turned away.
Really? What, for wearing too much or too little?
No, too regular, just regular clothes.
And by then, was that sort of iconic element to his personality emerging for you? And how did you begin to see that happen?
He invented this fashion with blue faces and everything. And first of all, he dressed his flatmate in it, Trojan. But when he saw how much attention that Trojan got, he thought, right, I'm doing it as well. So the day when he invented that look, it kind of changed him and who he was, because he looked different to everyone else when he went out. So everyone was kind of looking up to him and going, what's he wearing this week?
And did that change his personality, that sense of suddenly knowing that people were paying attention to him?
Probably made him even more of a show-off than he was before. No, he was still the same, really, but, you know, maybe even a bit more flamboyant.
What of his influence on fashion sort of in a longer-lasting way? Because here we are talking because we have the opening of this exhibition in London. I wonder what you make of that.
Fabulous show. There's all his costumes there. You can see how they move on and get different. And when he started working for Lucian Freud, because he was a model for Lucian, he becomes even more aware of his body because he's with his naked body a lot of the time. And so a lot of the outfits like show changing of the body shape.
So there's fashion there, there's photography obviously there as well.
Oh yeah, of course. And sort of old magazines and photos of everyone and Polaroids.
Were there particular bits of it that stood out for you?
There's a model of me that I was very keen to see. It wasn't busty enough. They couldn't make the model busty enough, but still, that was nice.
At its height, I mean, what were some of the big names who used to go to Taboo? Oh,
it was rumoured that Mick Jagger went there one night. Loads of pop stars, George Michael, all the fashion designers, Boy George, all the people from the magazines.
You mentioned the artist Lucian Freud, and you have been immortalized, haven't you, in an artwork by Lucian Freud, which once you describe it, I suspect some listeners will kind of get what you're describing.
Well, it's a very fat bird, naked, lying on a sofa. And there's four of them. I think two of them on the sofa, one of them on the floor and one of them in a chair.
Let's end the conversation where we began with Lee Bower in this exhibition. Obviously, Lee, sadly, is no longer with us and hasn't been with us for a good long while. What do you think he would make of what is now being done about him, displayed about him, written about him?
I think he'd be absolutely thrilled because there's a big exhibition at the Tate Gallery.
I was about to say Tate Modern next year, isn't it? A much bigger one. Yeah.
And then I wrote a book about Lee 27 years ago and that's being republished, ready for the Tate. It's all very exciting. Shame he's not here to see it, but
it's the next best thing.
Exactly.
Sue Tilley there, friend of Lee Bowery, whose nightclub Taboo is the centre of an exhibition, a new one here in London. BBC World Service, this is NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. In a moment, we'll return to our top story, the fighting in the Middle East. But first, it's been a year since Hollywood's writers ended their months-long strike and went back to work. Many expected to return to the booming days of streaming once the strikes ended. But those days seem to be over and Hollywood's workers are being hit hard. The BBC's Regan Morris reports from Hollywood.
Film production is actually struggling. The hardest hit Hollywood.
I mean, our biggest industry here is being hit pretty hard.
But for many in the industry, business still has not bounced back.
This is not the happy ending Hollywood hoped for. The lights and cameras are ready to roll, but there's been very little action since the strikes ended.
It's been crushing. It's been devastating.
So, actor and aerial cinematographer Michael Fortin was at the heart of Hollywood's golden age of streaming, turning his drone hobby into a profitable business. And for a decade, he was flying high above film sets, creating previously unthinkable, sleek, sleek aerial shots for movies and TV shows.
2 years ago, when after the pandemic, things were just booming. I just worked today for the first time since April. I've only worked 22 days since the strike ended. So it's been, you know, incredibly difficult. I should say, I mean, my wife is an actress. My 9-year-old son is an actor. I work in the industry both behind and in front of the camera. And so our existence has been Hollywood. It's what we know.
What they don't know is if they can continue to make a living in Hollywood. But production is down around the globe, largely because companies haven't figured out how to make streaming profitable.
The air has come out of the content bubble.
Matthew Bellany is the founder of Puck News, which covers the business of Hollywood.
There was a run-up in the level of film and television production over 10 to 12 years. All of these traditional Hollywood players launched streaming services and were competing with the upstart streamers, and it caused an overheating of the content market.
Not all streaming services are expected to survive, and more consolidation and layoffs are likely. Screen Actors Guild chief negotiator Duncan Crabtree Ireland says Hollywood is known for reinventing itself.
So much of the strikes, the writer's strike and the actor's strike, was about AI protections, and now we've seen some sort of legislative protections in, and I just keep interviewing people who are losing their homes, getting evicted. I mean, it's rough out there. Do you ever think, was it worth it?
I think in this case, it clearly was not only worth it, but absolutely necessary. Because if we hadn't fought for the protections that we achieved last year, the threat to our members and, frankly, to others working in the industry would be far greater. What makes these companies special, what gives them their unique ability to create value, is their relationship with creative talent.
And until that creative talent gets back to work, there'll be less for the rest of us to binge watch.
That was the BBC's Regan Morris reporting from Hollywood. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. Now, a year tomorrow, a brutal series of attacks took place that shocked the world and changed the Middle East.
Hello, I'm Celia Hatton. Well, let's start with a fast-developing story. Palestinian militants appear to have launched a major assault on Israel, the biggest in years. Thousands of rockets have been launched into Israel from Gaza, and dozens of militants appear to have entered southern Israel. Here's what we know.
Well,
so
almost 1,200 people were killed by Hamas militants that day. Two of them were Bilha and Yaakovi Inon. Their home in southern Israel was destroyed by a close-range missile fired from Gaza. Their son, Maoz Inon, shared his thoughts with the BBC.
I want my parents to be victims of peace, not victims of war, because I won't be able to justify it for myself and for my children that their grandparents, my parents, died for war. There is no excuse in dying for a war, but there is a great meaning in doing everything you can for peace. And the demand for hope, the demand for an alternative, the demand for peace and reconciliation is rising. And we are here to answer this demand and, again, to prove that once again, peace will prevail. And tomorrow, family and friends, we are gathering at the foundation of my parents' house. This was left from their house. They were burned alive in the house. And so friends and family were just going to gather there. We'll play and sing some song they loved. We'll share memories. We're going to cry together. And we're going to vow again that we're going to do everything we can, that the memory will be a memory of peace.
Israel launched a military campaign in Gaza that's now thought to have killed over 40,000 people and destroyed half the buildings in the territory. Around 100 Israeli hostages remain unaccounted for. According to Israel, 251 Israelis and foreigners were taken during the 7th of October attacks. Michael Levy's brother, Or Levy, was abducted at the Nova Music Festival. He last saw his brother on videos made that day.
I can't forget the look on his face, on Or's face, when I saw it. He was completely terrified. He was crying. That's, you know, something I will never forget. I've been trying to do whatever I can every morning since that horrible day. I wake up and ask myself what I should do now. I travel the world and try to tell the story. The hostages are human. They are not just numbers or names. This is not about politics. This is not about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's about human beings. All has to come back home to his now 3-year-old son who already lost his mother and needs a father. Obviously, I'm not naive. I know that the only solution for this will be diplomatic, but it's about people. There has to be a solution and there has to be a deal. But the only way to end the suffering for both sides is to release the hostages and then this war will end. This is what I'm looking for. This is what we all here in Israel wants to see. We want to live in peace. It's the international community's time to react. The international community's time to tell Hamas enough. And you know, I have 3 little girls and I want them to grow up in peace. I want them to not too afraid to walk on the streets like they are now. Hamas and Hezbollah are not doing any good to Lebanon and people in Gaza. So I think that terrorist organizations, they have to be eliminated. The only thing I want them to do is to find a way to seal a deal that will release all the hostages and to do whatever it takes to release them. We can deal with everything else later.
Michael Levy ending there on what he wished the Israeli government would do to secure his brother's release from Hamas. Let's speak now live to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, who is in kibbutz near Oz, about 2 kilometres from the border with Gaza. Lise, how is the anniversary being marked there?
It's really chill to be near Oz. It used to be 400 people, many of them peace activists, talking about the peace you just heard Michael Levy expressing a hope for. And they suffered terribly. A quarter of the population of near Oz was either killed or kidnapped. 117 in all. And today, and there was a commemoration for some of the families who lost loved ones today. Only 2 people live in near Oz now, out of a community of, and we've just driven down the road and I'm at the entrance now to, you just meant you had spoken.
I'm sorry, we're having difficulties, obviously, with Lise's line from Israel there. We'll come back to Lise Doucette at kibbutz near Oz as soon as we can. In the meantime, let's talk now to David Mensa, who is spokesman for the Office of the Israeli Prime Minister. Mr. Mensa, welcome. Did you envisage, 12 months on from those awful attacks, that Israel would still be fighting?
Well, we certainly knew that the Jewish people and Israel had experienced the worst day of Jew killing since the 1930s and 40s. We heard stories that were reminiscent of what our grandparents told us, who managed to get out of Europe. We heard the most chilling stories of rape, of torture, of beheadings, of families burnt alive, of joy of killing. That's the only way I can describe it. These GoPro videos, which Hamas encouraged their participants to take, their terrorists to take, the sheer joy of killing, that's what is the thing which I remember the most. Look, this country is still in shock. I think there's no other way to put it. Such a terrible disaster which befell our people. And people did ask themselves this very simple question, you know, we, the Jewish people, understand about suffering and about victimization. We've experienced it many times before. So what's different now? And the answer is that we have Israel now and we have an army to defend ourselves. And that's precisely what we've done for the last 12 months. In the final analysis, the government's real responsibility is to provide security for its people. And that's what this government has set out to do, to defend our people. So in Gaza, We made a decision to ensure that Gaza could no longer be a threat to our people, that Hamas would be taken apart militarily and its governing capabilities, and of course, to get our hostages home, that the Hamas should set them free right now. And of course, more latterly, it's been to get our people home, back to their home in the north of this country that have been evicted by Hezbollah.
And on that subject, what could you tell us about the progress of the IDF campaign in Lebanon? And tell us, please, what victory in that campaign would look like?
Well, victory is extremely clear. Our objective is to get our people home, nothing more, nothing less. It's not about, we haven't got any territorial ambitions in Lebanon. We've got no border dispute with Lebanon. The border is precisely where the UN wanted it to be. It's called the Blue Line. We are at that border. But unfortunately, since October the 8th, the genocidal murderers of Hezbollah decided to try and mimic what Hamas had done. They set about firing 10,000 rockets upon us. It's in contravention of UN Security Resolution 1701, which calls specifically, and this answers your question, it calls specifically for Hezbollah not to be between our border and the Litani River. Now, Lebanon have never adhered to that, unfortunately, to our everlasting grief. They've never agreed to that. They've allowed their country to be hijacked by Hezbollah. And we just want a northern border free. That's exactly what we want. We want to get our 70,000 people back into their homes in Israeli sovereign territory. And the same as with Gaza. We want to remove the threat to be able to live in peace in this neighborhood.
And can I ask you before you go, please, are you concerned about an ebbing of support for Israel among some of its Western allies now?
Look, in the final analysis, we're always on our own in these situations. Of course, we value the friendship and the support of the US government and other allies as well, who have been side by side with us, shoulder to shoulder for so many years now. And of course, we value that. But, you know, it's my son that I just sent off into the army to put on a green uniform. Okay, it's our soldiers which are paying the price to defend this country. It's our people which put themselves in harm's way, the way that this country has come together almost universally, wall-to-wall support to defend this country. And ultimately, we of course value the support, but we don't want anyone sympathy. What we want is victory, and that's what we're going for.
David Mensah, spokesman for the office of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, many thanks. Let's return now to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, if the line holds. She's in southern Israel, been on the move, visiting kibbutzes that were under attack exactly a year ago. Lise.
Yes, and apologies to our listeners. We were entering the site, such a poignant site now, where the Nova Music Festival, a night of celebration, turned into a morning of horror. And the fields where music had played and people had danced is now a memorial to those who died there, an avenue of portraits, smiling faces of young people, mostly Israelis, but others from around the world who'd come to this festival. And there will be tomorrow, on October the 7th, an official ceremony there. There'll be one in Tel Aviv, and there will be ones in other kibbutzes across southern Israel, where, remembering you, it's... The pain is still raw. People have not been living in their communities. I don't know whether how much you heard, but in Nir Oz, which used to be such a vibrant, beautiful agricultural community of 400 people, only two people are living there now. And of course, their loved ones, the hostages, are still across the border in Gaza, just miles away. And you could see amidst the photographs and the candles, there's also the posters which have Prime Minister Netanyahu's face on them with the slogan in Hebrew, abandoned, that those of the families of the hostages who believe the Prime Minister haven't done enough to brought their loved ones home. And of course, the anger too, that in places like Nir Oz, the Israeli security forces only came to the kibbutz hours after the assault in the early hours of the morning, and they also felt abandoned them. But most of all, today, tomorrow, and for many days to come, it will just be a day to grieve.
Many thanks. That's our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. In Israel, near the border with Gaza, 1 year on, almost exactly, from the October the 7th attacks. You're listening to the BBC World Service. We're live from London. We're NewsHour. This is Paul Henley with NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. Along with the latest overnight strikes on Lebanon, a series of heavy airstrikes has been reported in Gaza. The Israeli army said it had been targeting Hamas operatives in the north of the territory. Abdul Wahab Hamad is a humanitarian worker in Gaza. We first spoke to him earlier in the year when he and his family were forced to leave Rafah. Today we asked us to tell us what his life was like now. He sent this series of voice notes from Gaza.
Right now I'm in a camp in Deir el-Balah, but we continue to survive. It isn't a living conditions, it's barely a surviving conditions. Crowded in tents, broken structures, trying to survive in impossible circumstances. My family has endured really many hardships. We've been displaced 10 times, nearly 10 times. My uncle was killed just a few weeks ago. His young daughter, Farah, she lost her left eyes. On the top of that, I have lost more than 80 members of my extended family during this war. Hunger is everyday battle. Sometimes we managed to eat once a day, but there are days that we go without eating at all. Accessing running water is extremely difficult. It has become a near impossible dream for many. Hope is what keeps us going, but hope isn't enough. It won't save us. We need actions on the ground. Now, Gaza is on the brink of a public health disaster, if it's not already there. Sanitation systems are collapsed. Diseases are spreading. Really, the international community must prevent this catastrophe from deepening. Behind every number, every statistic, there is a family. There are people just like me struggling to hold on.
Abdul Wahab Hamad, who's an aid worker in Gaza. So as Israel prepares to mark the anniversary of the October the 7th attacks, while prosecuting war on two fronts against its arch enemies Hezbollah and Hamas, an end to the violence that is the hallmark of that part of the Middle East at the moment seems depressingly distant. I've been speaking to Gilead Sher, a former chief of staff to the ex-Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. He was one of the chief negotiators of the Camp David summit of 2000. And also to Nasser al-Qudwa, who was the foreign affairs minister of the Palestinian National Authority.
We have been working, Yod Olmert and myself, on a proposal, not only with regard to Gaza, but a proposal that would cover three very important issues from our point of view. The overall political solution, that's one. Two, the necessary cessation of the war in Gaza, that's two. And three is the future status of Jerusalem. But we were careful not to pretend that we are presenting an overall political plan, because this is the job of the people in office, and we are acutely aware that we are not.
Given the state of the violence at the moment, Gilead, it seems almost delusional right now to be contemplating a peace framework, doesn't it?
I never stopped believing in a peaceful solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. However, tomorrow is the 7th of October, a year to the horrific massacre by Hamas in Israeli towns and kibbutzim. You know, the Hezbollah did not stop for even one day the bombarding of civilian centers in Israel. We are currently confronting multiple fronts in the Hamas in Gaza, the Hezbollah in Lebanon, the terrorists in the West Bank, Iran, of course, the Houthis, just name it. Some of these threats are, I would say, existential. Nevertheless, and despite the fact that we still have 101 hostages in the hands of terrorists, I believe that it is still possible, if we do put this in the right context, a robust coalition, US-led, of regional and global actors for the sake of normalization for security, for peace, for the campaign against Iran. This is possible. It is not imminent. We have to understand that the situation is changed dramatically. We are waging a war against terrorism, against fundamental radicalism, for those who would like to see us annihilated.
Nasser, you've heard spelled out the traditional route to some kind of negotiated peace, US-led. Is that key? Is that acceptable to Palestinian figures too?
No, first, let me say that there is never a good moment in the Middle East to make any move. Nevertheless, I thought that it was unfortunate that not a word was uttered about the genocidal war that is being waged by the Israeli army in Gaza. Gaza is destroyed totally, completely. If we want to present a picture, we need to be balanced and we need to be accurate. It was necessary in the midst of the war and the terrible situation to have a voice saying this is not, cannot be the way forward, and we need to have a political solution. I mean, there is not any other political solution. This is the only possible political solution, and we have to work on it in all cases and in spite of the very gloomy situation that exists now.
Isn't it odd, Gilead, to underline the importance of the US role when the Israeli government has consistently ignored US advice and pleas?
I believe that what we need is a collective action against the evil axis. War could have been over long ago had Hamas released hostages and stopped terrorizing Israel.
But my point was that the US has consistently asked Israel to row back, and Israel has consistently ignored that.
How would you defend Israel otherwise? I am in full agreement with Nasser that a political framework around the two-state for two-people solution is necessary. But it requires understanding what the reality is. Instead of accusing Israel with ill-grounded accusations, look for once into the reality, which is a necessary campaign against Hezbollah, against Iran, and land.
What are the ill-grounded accusations?
Genocide, for one.
Come on. I mean, listen, there is a case before the ICJ, South Africa versus Israel, accusing Israel of violating the treaty on the prevention of the crime of genocide. I mean, that's clear. We need to change our thinking. We need to change the way we are looking at the situation. We need to see what the wrongs that we are doing, not only the other side is doing. This is very important. And by the way, I do agree with Gilad about the main point he proposed, the necessity of a coalition. But I don't see the coalition formed against anyone. And I see the coalition formed to push for the political solution and ending the war.
Nasser al-Qudwa and Gilead Sher underlining the difficulty of finding peace in the Middle East. Thanks for listening to this edition of NewsHour.
One year on from the Hamas attack on Israel, Global News podcast listeners have been sending in their questions for BBC correspondents about everything that's happened since, about the escalating conflict in the wider Middle East, and where we might go from here to try to bring an end to the bloodshed. Find the Global News Podcast special edition on the Middle East in the regular Global News Podcast feed, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. One year on from the Hamas attack on Israel, Global News podcast listeners have been sending in their questions for BBC correspondents about everything that's happened since, about the escalating conflict in the wider Middle East, and where we might go from here to try to bring an end to the bloodshed. Find the Global News podcast special edition on the Middle East in the regular Global News podcast feed, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.